Hey, has lichen sclerosis messed with your relationships? You know, partner, family, friends, even at work? Then you need to join us at the Holistic Healing Summit this May 13th to the 17th, because we're bringing all the experts. We're going to be talking about intimacy, sex, as well as how do you talk to your family, friends, provider, boss? All of those things. And this is a free event, live, virtually, so you can catch it anywhere in the world, May 13th to the 17th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. We've got sessions going on all day. Get more information at lssupportnetwork.org/WHS. That's lssupportnetwork.org/WHS.
Hey, welcome. Thank you for coming to listen to the Lichen Sclerosis Podcast. My name is Kathy, and this is our journal of learning about and living with lichen sclerosis. Each week, I research or speak to someone about an aspect of lichen sclerosis and bring you the information so you don't have to go searching. I bring you the real talk without the medical jargon. And this week, we're continuing down the nutrition path. Food, diet, LS. We hear it all the time. Today, we're going to talk to an LS warrior who was diagnosed less than a year ago, but she has a special qualification in this field. Erica Ebrill is only 23 years old, but she is packed to the brim with so much information. She is a dietitian, and when she was first diagnosed with LS, having the skills and the resources that she did, she researched LS and diet because that's her jam. Today, she's going to sit down with us, tell us what she found in her research, and give us the goods. We're going to talk about low oxalate diets, nightshade vegetables, triggers, and we're going to talk about what we should be eating in order to help our LS. So if you haven't listened to Heather Cohen's story and her last episode where she broke down nutrition therapy for us beautifully, that is an episode packed with information. You definitely want to listen to that one and listen to this one because they work together. Before we start the conversation, I want to thank our sponsor, the Lichen Sclerosis Support Network, bringing information, education, support, and most importantly, hope to people with lichen sclerosis. If you haven't signed up for the Lichen Sclerosis Support Virtual Meetup, you still have time. Tomorrow is our next meetup, and I want to see you. So go to lssupport.net and sign up, get all the information you need, and come on over. We meet from 2 to 4 and 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every other Saturday. So go on over there and sign up. Without further ado, I bring you my conversation with Erica Ebrill.
This information is for educational purposes and does not constitute medical advice. Speak to your medical provider before making any changes to your care.
I'm sure because you have LS, it's more of a personal study than just your normal academic study.
Yeah, as we all know, LS is not exactly a walk in the park. The diagnosis in itself is a pretty shocking one, as we've all experienced. I definitely took it from the same angle as an academic would, in the fact that I did go through all the literature databases and I did do how an academic would actually research or look up whatever possible findings I could find on diet and LS. But yes, it was something that I did actually do when I first got diagnosed, but it was a really rough one. And then over the last week or so, I actually did what's a more thorough one. Right. So what is actually part of lichen sclerosis? What is actually looking at diet and not just saying diet could be a factor and that's why it's come up. And then once you screened those, I came with about five, and two of them was not specific to lichen sclerosis. And then there were like three others that actually looked at LS, which I'm more than happy to share with you guys. And also I've downloaded them so I can definitely give you access to those as well, like the PDF copies. So you guys can all read it.
Yes, yeah. I will put that in the membership. That would be amazing. So if you want to get access to these, join the LS Warriors waitlist, and then you will have access to it when I open the doors, which will be soon. Let's talk about those three. And what did you find?
So this was a clinical trial done in Italy. Basically what happened, they got women with mild to moderate lichen sclerosis, and they got 23 women, and they gave them this cream that has avocado and soybean extracts in it while also having vitamin E and some other moisturizing properties. These women had mentioned before that corticosteroids don't work for them. So that's the criteria that they had for these women going into it. And so they had to use the cream twice a day for 24 weeks. And then they had a diet strategy. So they then also had the avocado and the soybean oil extracts and vitamin E and phytosterols, which is a type of antioxidant. And they had these in a capsule, which the women also took for the first 12 weeks. And what they found was that there was actually an improvement in the symptoms that the women experienced, both the white skin, and they do actually have pictures, as well as like the itching and burning and pain during sex as well. They did mention, though, that by the 24 weeks, so after they did the cream and they also did the diet strategy, the improvement that they saw in lichen sclerosis symptoms would be about the same as if you used corticosteroid for 12 weeks. So they did actually mention that it wasn't as effective, but it still helped to relieve some of the symptoms. I think, though, it's important when reading this study, and I know this has come up in previous podcast episodes as far as what to look for in a study. Obviously, it wasn't blinded, because the researchers knew what they were giving, the women knew what they were getting, and also there was no group of women who had mild to moderate lichen sclerosis and maybe were having the corticosteroid treatment or had no treatment. So there was no control group, which kind of makes it hard to make a comparison. The other thing that's important to look at is the fact that there was actually a really small number of women. They started off with 23, but then during the treatment process, by the end of the 12 weeks, three women had no improvement whatsoever, and so they were actually removed from the study. So you really only had 20 women to see the effects on this. And I guess the other thing is, while avocado and soybean, they both have a lot of fatty acids and also antioxidants that are anti-inflammatory. From looking at the study, you don't know whether the cream has more of an effect or that capsule that they had, if eating it actually had more of an effect. So it's one of those things where looking at that, you go, okay, how much of an effect does diet really have in this big scheme of things? That was one study that I found, and that was done in 2015, so not too long ago. And then the other one I found, this one was a case control study. So with case controls, it's very observational. They don't give an intervention. They don't say change your diet or change what cream you're using or that sort of thing. It's purely observational, which has its advantages and disadvantages, but it's definitely something that a lot of studies on nutrition or a lot of studies that are meant to inform our best practice guidelines, some of them have to be observational, because the best way of not actually putting a bias to your population, if that makes sense.
So they were basically just watching what these women were already doing.
Yeah. Okay. So they had 75 cases of women with lichen sclerosis, and then they had 223 women who didn't have lichen sclerosis, and they tried to make the two groups very similar as far as the same location that they lived in, so they were exposed to the same environmental factors, the same age group or very similar age group. And I think they all went to the same hospital, or they were all in the same catchment area.
Can I ask, why would they have such a larger number in the control group versus the number in the infected group, I'll call them? Why not the same number?
That's a good question. And that's actually one of the questions I had, because it does mean that you have
you
do skew the percentages. That being said, because all the 223 women actually came from a hospital, so they all had another reason that they were going in hospital for. It wasn't lichen sclerosis, but it could have been, I don't know, some other inflammatory condition, which they didn't actually check for in the study either. They did check if they had other autoimmune diseases, but they didn't really check what else, like cystic fibrosis or any other sort of disease like that. And so I imagine that what they did by trying to pick 223 was that if they get so many people, then that kind of variation that could possibly happen from other diseases that the people might have kind of nullifies, because you have so many different people and they're all so different. The more people you have, the more that variation explains less of a difference between the controls and the lichen sclerosis people, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So basically what they did was they had these two groups of people, and then they did a food frequency questionnaire, which is basically when you ask someone, okay, in the past like few weeks or few months, how many times have you eaten like dairy, or how many times have you eaten carrots? And it's not a very accurate way of looking at someone's diet, but it is a very simplified way. And when you're doing a lot of people, which, I mean, compared to other nutrition studies, this isn't a huge number of people, but it's still a decent amount. It's a very quick way to get a picture. And this was also done in Italy. They wanted to see if retinoids, so different forms of vitamin A, and carotenoids, which are the precursors to vitamin A, they're like the stuff that make your carrot orange or the stuff that make your spinach green. They wanted to see if a diet high in those would be associated with less lichen sclerosis. So they basically took the cases, they took the controls, they gave them the same food frequency questionnaire. They did only look at the specific sources of these retinoids and carotenoids in the Italian diet. So it definitely doesn't give a whole picture of all the different forms that they could have gotten of vitamin A or carotenoids, but they were just honing in on those specific types. And what they did find was people who had lichen sclerosis, most of them actually didn't have a lot of carotenoids in their diet. Whereas in the control group, most of them actually had quite a high intake of carotenoids. Mm. So they ate a lot of carrots or they ate a lot of green vegetables. So one of the reasons why this is exciting is because we know that vitamin A is an anti-inflammatory. We also know that it does have an effect on the immune system as well. And so it possibly brings the question, oh, so maybe there is actually a link between diet and LS, and maybe eating like more carrots or more green vegetables or foods that are high in carotenoids can change how our body reacts to LS. It's not necessarily one to take for granted, but it does definitely pose those questions for further research. But they did actually find that, yeah, while carotenoids, there seemed to be this association, retinoids, so different forms of vitamin A, so the ones that were like in the milk and the dairy, they showed no association to lichen sclerosis. So there was no difference between the amount of vitamin A or retinoids that people in the lichen sclerosis ate compared to the people that were in the control group. So it was very specific to that carotenoid, which is the vitamin A precursor. Our body converts carotenoids to vitamin A. As you can tell, these studies, none of them were really like conclusive, but then that's also partly because there's not a lot of research on lichen sclerosis and diet. So you have to start somewhere to then actually get the funding to do more research.
Right. What can we take away from this study? Should we be eating more carrots and green vegetables?
Yeah, I think, look, it's up to you how factual you want to take this study, because obviously it's not enough to actually form guidelines for lichen sclerosis, because it's only one study. It's in Italy. It's not, hasn't really been shown in other populations, and it's very observational. There is actually research on autoimmune diseases and inflammation, which do suggest that a diet quite high in these carotenoids in fruits and vegetables, and that do have vitamin A, is actually quite protective in inflammation. So whilst it's not necessarily been shown so much in the lichen sclerosis group, apart from this one study, it's definitely something that you can start thinking about. And if you look at other studies that are on inflammation or autoimmune, it definitely seems to be a common trait. So definitely, I'm always an advocate for eating more vegetables and fruits. So if that convinces you to go down that path and then you see an effect, then that's awesome. By the way, that carotenoid study was done in the 1980s. So they may want to replicate it now that more people have probably been diagnosed than what they were in the 1980s.
Absolutely. And then were they not treating with steroids?
I think they did adjust the statistic based on that, but they didn't intervene whatsoever. So the women with lichen sclerosis, some of them may have been treating, some of them may have not. All they did was they looked at what are some associations between diet and this disease with a specific focus on vitamin A. So yes, as you can see, looking at this study, it's very general. And this is one of the things that we come across with research on diet. And so when people make these really strong conclusions based off studies like this, you have to go, I've read that paper. This was actually what happened. And I don't really know if it's enough to make a guideline sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. This third one is from where?
This third one is from Portugal. And basically, they got 228 patients with vulval lichen sclerosis. They interviewed them and they asked them about their diet and if there was any triggers that they found in their diet and lichen sclerosis. When they looked at this group of people, 85% of them actually did have symptoms. The rest of the group were asymptomatic. And then of the women that had symptoms, 74%, so about three quarters of that group, didn't have any food triggers. They didn't report any diet triggers for their flares. Only 26% actually said that their symptoms were triggered by a food.
That is so interesting because in the membership, we just had a 90-day symptom tracking challenge. And we just came together and compared our notes and our triggers and everything. And there were four of them that were tracking. I didn't track because I didn't have any symptoms, but four of them were tracking, and only one out of the four found any correlation with food.
Wow.
Yeah. The other three, it was stress. They found that stress was a trigger for them, and only one that food was a trigger. That's so that goes along right with your study there.
Yeah, pretty much exactly the same ratio. That's insane. Is the lady happy to say what the food trigger was?
If I can remember correct, dairy. Milk in particular. But it was, she said it was specific dairies. So I think it was she could eat cheese and she was good for a couple of days. But if she had milk, it was like almost instantaneous that she started itching, or it was vice versa. But it was definitely dairy. She said she also maybe suffer from celiac disease. So she also is off of gluten. And so if she has any kind of bread, she gets an upset stomach, and then that also might trigger her. But I don't know if like her getting sick might trigger stress, and because stress is also a trigger for her as well. So I don't know if it's so much of a trigger for her, but dairy definitely was a trigger for her.
Yeah. And it could be that like cheese, I know cheese, yogurt, they tend to be quite low in lactose compared to, say, for instance, milk. So that would be something that you may want to like follow up on, see if
Well, that was the other interesting thing was that she said the milk was lactose free. And she still had still triggered her.
Okay.
So that really threw us for a loop. Yeah. That threw us for a real loop.
Yeah. That's interesting. Very interesting. This study, when they actually looked at the quarter of the group that sort of said that they did have a food trigger, the number one food, like 50% of that 25%, they said that pork was a thing for them, which was really interesting because I think Heather Cohen in the last episode said that pork was something that she noticed as well. So pork seems to be a thing. And then the next one was spicy food, and also fried food was the third. Those were the top three. After that, there was stuff like dairy and other foods as well. But the top three seemed to be pork, spicy foods, and fried foods.
Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Because a lot of the time when I'm in the support groups, I'm hearing a lot about sugar, I'm hearing a lot about high oxalates and things like that, but no one's really mentioning anything about fried foods or pork or anything like that. So that's super interesting.
Yeah, I sort of then looked at the research more into pork because I was like, why are 50% of women saying pork? Like, that's a pretty, it's a really weird food compared to all the other sort of foods out there that are known to trigger allergies. But there is actually a protein in pork, which some people can actually be quite sensitive to, and they can have an allergy to that particular protein. So all allergies are related to proteins. That's something. Whether you have celiac disease, it's related to a wheat protein. If you're allergic to dairy, like actually have an allergy to dairy, it's actually related to the protein in dairy. So all allergies that are diet related are always related to the protein. So there is a protein, like a particular porcine, I think it's porcine protein in pork that's not in other meats. And some people can be hypersensitive to it, or they can have an allergy to it or an intolerance. And so they think that might be one of the reasons why, you know, 50% of this 25% of women that said that they had a food trigger actually related back to pork.
Super interesting. So all this is telling me is if you haven't listened to the last episode with Heather Cohen when she went through the nutrition therapy, you need to go listen to that. And then you need to get your food allergies tested, get that test done, because there's a lot of information that can come from it if you believe that food is a trigger. So let's go down that road. What do you recommend we do if we want to find out if food is a trigger for us?
If you definitely want to skip the guesswork and you want to find out what your food trigger is, highly recommend seeing a dietitian or a nutritionist that's trained in this department, because what they will do is they will put you on an elimination diet, but that's only so that they can then figure out what your triggers would be. And then what happens is after you go on that elimination diet and you test different foods, you then have an answer of which foods are related to my flares and which foods aren't. And then you're sort of able to figure out what diet or what sort of foods you want to eat from then on with that knowledge of which ones contribute to the flares and which ones don't. That's probably the fastest way to get that understanding. And the reason why I say to actually seek guidance with it and not do the elimination diet yourself and test it yourself is
like
because,
AIP and stuff.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Because what happens is a lot of women go on these elimination diets and they skip the reintroduction phase. So they go on an elimination diet, they're like, sweet, I've got no flares. I'm like, so cool, I'm chill, like I'm loving life. And then they're like, I'm just not gonna put any more food in my diet. That's it. I'm on an elimination diet for life. And the elimination diet should never be long-term. And the reason is because in doing the elimination diet, if you do it for a long period of time, you can actually develop intolerances that you didn't have before. But now your gut microbiome has adapted to the elimination diet. Your body has adapted to the elimination diet. And so maybe before, when you went on the elimination diet, you were only maybe intolerant to, say, two foods or one type of food or a particular chemical that's in food. And then by the time you finish the elimination diet, and if you're on it for, like, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years, and you're like, I'm mother life, symptom free. But you probably now have 10 intolerances because your microbiome has gone, oh, I'm not getting any of this food anymore. I don't need to, you know, create the enzymes to actually digest this particular food. Your body's, I don't need to create this to absorb this particular food. And so what happens is if you introduce those foods, then maybe you had the enzymes and you had the environment to digest it before, but because you've reprogrammed your body and your body's adapted to this new diet, you now are like, I'm intolerant to every food under the sun.
You went from bad to worse.
Yes, pretty much. On top of that, elimination diets are incredibly restrictive. So with your elimination diet, you can get social isolation and the fact that now you can't go out and eat with friends. If you are on it for a long term and you don't actually have a lot of the vitamins and minerals that you had before, especially if you're not doing the elimination diet under guidance. So you can develop nutritional deficiencies, which are not fun, if they do become quite serious. And so that's why I would also say, just from like a risk assessment or a risk perspective, to always seek guidance if you want to go down an elimination diet in a reintroduction sort of phase. Yeah.
I actually was thinking about doing the autoimmune paleo diet, which is AIP. And I started researching it and just reading about it. And then it was like, you can't eat this and you can't eat that. And I was just like, I'm a starve, because they're like, yeah, eat all the fish you want. And I'm like, I don't eat fish. I only eat fish that I eat is tuna. And I can't survive on tuna. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is not the diet for me. Okay. Yeah. We need to look for something else.
And absolutely. I think anyone can say that being on an elimination diet is not fun. In fact, I've had a lot of dietitians, actually, at least in my cohort, they do have intolerances or they do have food sensitivities. And one of them in particular, she did have a food intolerance, but they didn't know what it was. And so she did have to go down the elimination diet. And she was like, Erica, can I tell you, those are one of the worst, you know, months of my life. She was like, I couldn't eat anything. And I was so excited to figure out what I could eat afterwards. Yeah, highly recommend. Seek guidance. Don't skip the reintroduction phase. But yeah, seek guidance, purely because if you don't do it properly, you can actually get vitamin and mineral deficiencies, and also get your mental health will suffer because it's not the best diet ever.
Listen, my mental health was suffering just reading about it. Okay.
Yep.
I can't even imagine going through it. I'd be like, I'd be like this. They'd be like, what happened to Kathy? She just wanted the shock from the lack of food. Okay.
Well, your kids would be like, Mom, why are you eating this? Yeah. Why are you eating with us? Well, boiled rice, that looks pretty boring.
I'd be like, Mommy, get out of bed. No, there's nothing to live for anymore. I want a milkshake. No. Okay. Yeah.
So definitely get guidance. If you don't want to go down that path, as far as maybe it's just financially not an option, or you're not that desperate to find out and you want to just experiment, then yes, definitely journal your diet, journal what you eat, journal your symptoms. So that symptom tracker that you have is amazing. And you can definitely see if there are any correlations between what you eat and what you experience with LS. Also, not to mention, if you do end up going down the path where you do an elimination diet with the help of a dietitian or a nutritionist that's trained in that field, they love food journals. So if you can go there and you go, look, I've been journaling for X amount of weeks, this is what I think it might be, but I'm not really sure, the dietitian will be like, fabulous, this is amazing, because you've already just given them like half of the information that they need to get to you from the appointment anyway.
If you need a symptom tracker that you can customized for yourself and your needs. I do have one available, like Erica was mentioning. You can download it for yourself at lichensclerosispodcast.com/symptom tracker. It's a Google sheet, so you can just download it and customize it to your needs. There are also apps in the app stores that you can download that are symptom trackers. One of our members just created a post yesterday, I believe it was, for a symptom tracker app. It was called Bearable, B-E-A-R-A-B-L-E, and she is loving it. I think it's free to download, but I'm sure there's in-app purchases and things like that. But if you want to go old school, grab yourself a notebook and a pen or download my Google Sheet. So how long should we be tracking? If we're going to take the slow road, do it ourselves, mm-hmm. how long do you recommend we track for before we start looking for correlation?
It depends with everyone, because if you have other stresses in your life or other factors that you definitely know do flares, say for instance, stress and sleep, big mm-hmm. ones, I would probably track long enough that those things don't really matter in the big scheme of things. So say for instance, if you're having like preparing for exams or maybe you're having a really stressful period at work, if you only track for maybe those 2 weeks, it's probably not going to be very accurate, because right. you're dealing with other stuff that contributes to the flares. So long enough so that you can actually see if there are any correlations with diet and your symptoms that's different, or that's with all the other factors controlled, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing would be to consider is actually doing it at least for 4 weeks or for a menstrual cycle, because okay. hormones can affect it as well. So yes. Doing it at least a menstrual cycle, maybe two, because then you can also figure out, oh, maybe my hormones or yes. how I feel during the cycle actually has more of an effect than diet. I've noticed that, yes. you know, in that 1 week before I get my period, that's when my symptoms flare. And yes, I maybe had chocolate every time before I had my menstruation. But then you can then go, all right, so maybe this menstrual cycle, I'm going to just experiment and see if I don't have chocolate before right. my period and see if that makes a difference. And maybe you'll still experience the flare and you go, okay, clearly chocolate isn't a thing, it's really just my hormones. Or yes. then maybe your symptoms will go down and you go, huh, interesting, maybe like chocolate is a factor that contributes to that. Right. So that's why I say long enough for you to figure out a pattern, compared, like taking into account all the other factors that could potentially contribute to your symptoms.
That's a very good point about the menstrual cycle, because one of the ladies did find that at a certain point in her cycle, she did flare. And so it was just like, okay. And I've heard that from many other ladies, that either right before they get their period, they flare, or some that, you know, it's right after. It's just all very different. And like I said, you can customize that sheet that I created to track your menstrual cycle, add that to there and see if it is a factor for you. So that's very good. And especially because there's not a lot of research for reproductive age women, we have to create that research for ourselves. So we've got to experiment on ourselves to see what works, because the guidelines aren't made for us. What's out there on the Mayo Clinic, it's not made for us. It's made yeah. for postmenopausal women and prepubescent girls, because we're left out of the research. Just because you don't show up in the same way that the medical diaries say you should, doesn't mean that you're not suffering the effects. So you got to do your own research. So I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, and definitely I'd like, with that as well, and doing your own research, I know I've started advocating a lot for diet in support groups, only because I'm seeing support groups are full of people talking about, I quit this and this is amazing and you guys should all quit this, which support groups are great as far as giving you other people who have the same disease as you and another voice that you can communicate with. But I'd probably encourage anyone who's part of a support group, if you do see a post about diet and someone has seen an effect of removing something from their diet, to actually just go, that's interesting. It may work for me, it may not work for me. But yes, remember that is a particular person. They do not have the same body as you. They yes. do not have the same genetics as you. They do mm-hmm. not have the same gut microbiome as you. And yes. so what works for them doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work for you. Definitely try it if you want to. But I think just if I could encourage everyone to just question and go, that's interesting. I may try it, I may not, but I'm glad it works.
Amen. Woo, you heard it from a professional's mouth. She has went to school for many years and studied this. This is what I'm talking about. I say it all the time. I get questions all the time about diet. What diet should I follow? And my answer is always the same. LS is individualized and diet is individualized too. You have got to test what is right for you, because what might be right for me may not be right for you, and vice versa. And it mm-hmm. might diet might not even be anything have anything to do with you. So mm-hmm. you cannot take it as gospel and cut all the sugar out of your life, because sugar might not be a trigger for you. Same thing with gluten. Same thing with dairy. You got to test and you have to experiment. So get your journal, however you decide to track it, and keep good notes. I know a couple of the ladies who were tracking their food in particular, they were being real specific, like all the ingredients, because you might have a bag of mixed vegetables and you just put a bag of mixed vegetables. You don't know what vegetables was in there. You got to put in there carrots, mm-hmm. peas, whatever was in those foods. So that way you know exactly what's in there. She had some bread and she wrote down the ingredients that were in the bread, because bread yeah. is made different ways. So mm-hmm. you never know. White bread is different from wheat bread. And even if you, different companies use different ingredients. So yeah. you have to be specific if you're trying to find out what is triggering you, if you feel like there's a correlation mm-hmm. with what is triggering you. So mm-hmm. let's talk about some of the things that come up in the support groups. Let's go one by one. Let's talk about the low oxalate diet. As a dietitian, what do you got to say about the low oxalate diet?
So the low oxalate diet was actually created for people with kidney stones, because having a low oxalate diet kind of reduces the risk of kidney stones for people who predispose to getting it. So that's why it stands as a diet in nutrition therapy. Some people find that following an oxalate diet helps them, low oxalate diet, sorry, in reducing their inflammation. But currently, there's not strong evidence, at least in the literature, for a low oxalate diet with inflammation. So maybe there's a couple of clinical trials, but there's definitely not enough randomized controlled trials to create that guideline for oxalate diet reducing inflammation. If that was the case, I can 100% tell you dietitians working with autoimmune diseases, and we work with a few like rheumatoid arthritis, Hashimoto's, we'd be prescribing oxalate diets like left, right, and center. But
because I think there's one, you know what it is? There's one study that I saw that mentioned oxalates and we just jumped on it. Like it was like yeah. a fad. It was just like, yes,
yes,
oxalates. Okay. So yes. I think we're desperate sometimes. And when we see that one study, they're like, they said it could be possible. So it must be yeah. true.
Yeah. So, and as you can see, like even just me showing you some studies that are specifically to do with LS and diet, I've told you all the problems of those particular studies. And so unless you actually read the study yourself, you really don't know how convincing that evidence is. So right. That's why I wanted to share with you what's out there. So when you hear a study said this and this, then you can be like, what was the study? How many people were in the study? How did they assess diet? What are the other factors that we've talked about in the research studies that I just mentioned today? Definitely, yeah, that's something as far as one study and everyone jumping on that bandwagon. Yeah. There's also, I think, oxalates as well it's hard to do on your own, because normally, at least when we do low oxalate diet with people who have a predisposition for kidney stones, is we try to keep the oxalate content to below 50 milligrams, which is really hard to do because oxalate isn't something that's on a nutrition information panel. And often, unless you really try to hunt and find the data, that's the food analysis data that's gone, okay, how much oxalates are in a banana or how many oxalates are in this particular vegetable? It's really hard to actually do. And the other thing is that with the oxalate diet, it's not just the fruit and vegetables that change depending on the oxalate. Processing and cooking actually affects oxalate content a lot. Wow. Actually, I answered a question on a support group about this because one of the women asked, can I have pineapple on a low oxalate diet? And I pretty much said, you can have like pineapple juice as long as it's 100% pineapple, they're okay. But canned pineapple and dried pineapple is really high in oxalate. And it's mainly to do with the processing and how concentrated that oxalate ends up being. With canning, and this depends a lot on the manufacturer, but for at least fruits, they use heat, and so some of that water goes away and the fruit that's in the can becomes more concentrated, the oxalates become more concentrated, and that's the same with dried. However, if you, say for instance, cooked a food, some vegetables that might be moderately high in oxalate, if you boiled them and then you discarded the water, that would actually be lower in oxalate than just that vegetable itself, because some of that oxalate would have leached out into the water. And if you throw away the water, you're left with vegetable that has a lower oxalate than what it actually has. So it's one of those things when people follow a low oxalate diet, it's really hard to figure out how much oxalate am I actually having.
Very interesting. So another group that I've heard is nightshades. Like I have a lady actually in the membership who knows that as soon as she has nightshades, any kind of nightshade, she flares.
Nightshade vegetables, like they tend to be capsicum, tomatoes, another one, eggplants,
one. Tomatoes, I think tomatoes is one of her main triggers.
Yes. So I think like for people, definitely if you notice that it's a trigger for you, I would suggest not having it. I think but that being said, all I can say is like what the research says, so that if you are considering removing nightshades, then you can understand what does the research say for the majority of the population. For the majority of the population, there's not a lot of evidence for nightshades actually causing inflammation. In fact, tomatoes and a lot of those vegetables have antioxidants that are meant to reduce inflammation. So the guidelines are not actually to reduce nightshades, although if you do find that it's a trigger for you, then I'm not going to tell you to do differently. That's
right.
You've discovered what triggers your flares, and that's amazing. So again,
test, yes. Experiment, find out what your individual trigger is. And so my takeaway is that it's a very small number. This is not the general population that these are causing inflammation in. It's a very small population, and you just might be part of that. And I guess the same can go for sugar, dairy, gluten, and all the other things that people are cutting out of their diets. It's not a one-size-fits-all. And you have to test and find out what your own triggers are if you have a food trigger, because there's a 75% chance that you do not.
Yeah, and I think also is something, and you'll find out if you do actually get guidance from a dietitian or a nutritionist that's trained in this, that one of the things they will look at, as well as what diets you used to have as a kid, what foods you used to have, because if you say, for instance, and this is one of the reasons why I mentioned, if you go on an elimination diet for so long, your body can adapt, is that if we expose to those foods quite early on and we have no problems with them, then chances are we're less likely to, you know, be intolerant to them later on than, say, for instance, if I didn't have tomatoes right through my childhood and then all of a sudden I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to Italy or have tomato galore. And then, oh my God, this isn't so great anymore. Makes sense. It's one of those things that you have to look at yourself, look at who you are, what your experiences have been, and see whether it is something that you're willing to try or not.
Are there any foods or nutrients that can help us with our LS? Is it, instead of eliminating, what should we be eating?
Vitamin A has been shown. It actually is used a lot in the immune response, or how our body's immune system actually responds to things. So vitamin A is a good nutrient to improve your immune system. Vitamin Bs, particularly B6 and B12, these are ones that are found in, for instance, fish, meats, greens. They're in a lot of different foods, your vitamin Bs, and they also help with your skin health. And they are really just important in your immune cells functioning properly. And they are associated with improved immune function. So those would be the other ones. Vitamin C, it's an antioxidant, number one. So it's going to basically, whether we're exposed to pollution or just our basic processes that happen in our body, we produce a lot of things that can be harmful. And so a diet high in antioxidants, actually those antioxidants help remove those harmful things and prevent the inflammation from happening. So vitamin C is one antioxidant, vitamin E is another antioxidant. So vitamin E, they actually do find that if you have a lot of vitamin E in your diet, it can be immunosuppressive, especially in chronic inflammation. So that's why you will find studies that look at vitamin E, and that's why you do have vitamin E cream for stuff like psoriasis and dermatitis as well. So a lot of vitamin E is really good, and they're in stuff like your nuts, your seeds, and your greens as well. And vitamin D, as has been said before, really good for chronic inflammation. And they do actually find that people who do have autoimmune diseases tend to be deficient in vitamin D. If you haven't already checked your vitamin D levels, definitely check it, because it does play a role in how the immune system works. And you may find that there are some relief of actually just getting your vitamin D levels normal. Also, you'll just have more energy, because vitamin D is great in that department too. So those are the main vitamins. As far as minerals, zinc is another one that's meant to improve our immune system. Folate, which is in a lot of green leafy vegetables as well. Selenium, that's in your Brazil nuts, but also meats as well, and fish and nuts. And then omega-3 fatty acids, they're also anti-inflammatory. So as you can see, there's kind of trends with all these nutrients, and the fact that a diet, you know, high in omega-3s, whether it be from flax seeds or walnuts or fish or seaweed or egg as well has omega-3s. You can also get omega-3s from, there's a small amount in meats that tend to be grass-fed. So if you get like grass-fed beef, that tends to have higher omega-3s than beef that hasn't been or has been grain fed. So as you can see, running trend with all these nutrients, lots of fruits and veggies, whole grains, and fish and healthy meats. And that's pretty much it.
Some of what you're saying is also what Heather was saying. So if you haven't listened to the last episode about nutrition therapy with Heather Cohen, that's like a sister episode to this one. You want to listen to both of them if you really are serious about your nutrition, as far as your autoimmune disease or your just inflammation in general. Definitely packed with so much information. So, Erica, where can people follow you if they want some more information on just diet and or just to ask you a question? Where can they get in touch?
I do have an Instagram account that's sort of dedicated to actually looking at the research and answering people's questions of diet with research. So you can look up Erica's Appetite. So basically appetite, but an apple. Or you can just look up Erica Dietitian, and I should come up as well on Instagram. You can also email me, ericaebel.dietitian@gmail.com. And yeah, if you have any questions, you want me to research anything for you, while I have access to all these different literature databases, I'm more than happy to do it for you. It's the geeky thing that I love doing, where I love reading about nutrition. And if I can help people in the process learn more about diet as well, yeah, then I'm more than happy to do
so. Thank you so much for just wow. Just wow. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
It's all good. It was lovely.
I told you this was going to be another information-packed conversation. She knows what she's talking about. She's done the research. And if there's anything that you would like her to research for you with pertaining to diet, I will have all of her information in the show notes. So just click your app and her information should be there. Or you can go to lichensclerosispodcast.com/diet. And again, all of her information will be there. So thank you, Erica, one more time for spending that time with us and giving us all the goods. So what are you doing for your diet? Are you making any changes? Are you looking for your triggers? Do you know what your triggers are? Email me at Kathy with a K at Lichen Sclerosis Podcast, or DM me on Instagram at Lichen Sclerosis Podcast. I want to know. Let me know what's going on. And like I said, you can always come and talk to me at the virtual meetup every other Saturday, 2 to 4 or 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we can talk about it. Easy peasy. I'm so excited because Lichen Sclerosis Support Network is coming out with yet another freaking project, because they're awesome. A provider directory. Yeah, you heard me. Provider directory. So you can put in your city, your state, and see what LS providers have been referred by other LS patients. Okay. I like it. And it's searchable. And not only will you be able to find doctors, there's some pelvic floor physical therapists in there. There's functional doctors in there. We got the whole gamut. And if you're curious about what clinical trials are available, we got them in there too. And it's a working database. So we're constantly adding, we're constantly updating. If you have an amazing practitioner that you want to add and refer to the list, girl, all you gotta do is let me know. Email me, DM me. All the information is in your podcast app, in the show notes, or go to the website, lichensclerosispodcast.com/diet. I hope you have an amazing week, and I will talk to you next time. Bye.